Hello?
Hi, Carlos. It's Trister again.
Okay. I'm ready, whenever you are.
Okay, great. So, I was curious, what was one of your first memories that was related to drumming or to rhythm? I'm just interested in sort of your musical beginnings. How did you first feel that percussion was your calling?
Well, I started playing drums when I was in diapers. My parents told me, I really don't remember, but my parents tell me about a time when I was just a couple of, was already walking, so I guess I was more than 9 months, and they bought a little snare drum. The kind that you wear around with a strap, and they found that I was incredibly drawn to it, and I just wouldn't let. I had to sleep with the drum and play it all day long and make a racket, and they were very tolerant with that. My mother had come from a family of musicians and dancers, so they were very, you know. Oh, look how nice the boy's playing drums. And then I also remember being around, I guess I was in school, so I might have been five, kindergarten, and that's when I got a pair of bongos, little thumbtack bongos. And I always played them, and it just, when I was 14 was when I joined a band. So I had already been playing most of my life when I first joined a band at 14.
Yeah, so you've already gotten lots of practices. What kind of band was it?
Oh, the first band that I was in was my cousin was a guitar player. That's from my mother's side of the family, my maternal cousin. And he had learned from our uncle. He learned how to play guitar. So we started a Santana cover band.
Great.
Yeah. So that was way back. Yeah, that's when Santana's first album came out. And we played together for, a number of years. We had that band. And it was a great band. We're actually still friends after all these years. Of course, my cousin, because we're related, but some of the original members of that band, we're still in touch, and we're still friends, and we play together occasionally.
That's great. So, you also started playing pro pretty early, judging by the material that you sent. That was pretty amazing. How did that happen? How did you get started? I mean, a lot of teenagers get together and play and jam, and, you know, it never really coalesces into something more serious, but it sounds like for you that happened fairly early. What's the story behind that?
Well, out of that band, that band was called Devotion, and for by no accident, we had all said that we were going to devote our lives to music. And my cousin, Louis Perez, he was the guitarist in Devotion, but then he got called for another job with a band called Seguida. And Seguida was a Latin rock original band instead of that cover band that we were doing. We were doing everyone else's material, and we had started playing, you know, high school parties and, you know, all kinds of small events, and we were doing well, you know, working. We were actually working and making money as musicians, even by the time we were 15 and 16. So my cousin got drafted into this other band, and I went to go see what he was doing, and I thought, wow, what a great band. So I started just hanging around. They already had a percussionist in the band, but I hung around long enough for him to quit and them to ask me in his place. And by that time, they had an album already out on Fania Records. Are you familiar with Fania Records?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, I've definitely heard the name, and I know that it's a significant label.
Yeah, Fania was the premier label for salsa during the 70s and 80s. like the Fania All-Stars that played, you know, pretty much internationally.
I think that's where I heard about the label was through you know, crossing paths with them in various, I mean, not literally, but, you know, reading about them.
Yeah.
In various capacities,
so. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, but at the time it sounds like Fania was also branching out a little bit into rock.
We were the only band on Fania that was experimenting with anything other than salsa. We were the young experimental band, and we actually won awards. There was a Latin Music Awards. I can't even remember what year that was, maybe 77, 70. Yeah, I think it was 77, 78, where we won Best Latin Rock Band of the Year, even over Santana. It was, you know, it was a great band. We had two albums out, and they're actually still in circulation after all these years. They've been brought out and remixed and still in distribution. Somebody bought out Fania, and I think they may be on a different label now, but they're still out there. So anyway, that band, because of playing with Seguida, which was now nationally recognized and touring nationally, and I was maybe 18, 19 at the time, that then led to another Latin rock band called Malo asking me to join them. If you're not familiar with Malo, Malo was founded by Carlos Santana's brother, George Santana. And they were originally a California band, and they broke up in California, and one of the guys bought the name and came out here and regrouped in New York with all new members, and I was part of that band. So from Seguida, I went to Malo, which was actually an even more famous band. And at the time, I was probably 18, 19. So I was doing...
So how did that affect your... are you still, you know... How should I put this? So, I mean, that's a pretty formative experience to have as a young man and as a young artist. Do you still feel any of the resonances from that time? I mean, are there still things that you picked up then and that you learned then, or maybe mistakes you made back then that you... feel how I still continue to shape in a positive way what you're doing now?
Yeah, there was, oh God, I learned so much during that time. I basically learned how to be a musician and how the difference between a real, how can I put it, a working musician that hits the streets and really, you know, works, as opposed to an academic musician that comes straight out of school and really has very little to do with the working world, the gigging world. Yeah, I saw that very clearly even when I was very young. And I now have a son who is in college studying music, and I can certainly tell him the difference between what he's doing academically and what the real working world is all about. Yeah, there's...
Yeah, that's good. It's good you can talk on that experience. So, I mean, he's getting kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
So, what lessons did you learn any interesting musical lessons from this gigging world? Was there anything that shaped your playing?
Yeah, lots, yeah. I would say first and foremost, being eclectic, because... From its very inception, this band and the band before it were based on musical syncretisms, you know, a crossover into different styles. So we had basically Latin music and rock and roll that had crossed over. But then when Seguida did its original version, it was Latin and rock, but also soul and funk and even disco. So that kind of laid the foundation for me exploring even more world musics. Immediately, also part of that project was some Brazilian music. So I started studying lots and lots of Brazilian music and delving deeper into Afro-Cuban traditional music. And so by the time I left New York and moved out to California, I was very well-versed in a variety of musical styles, which I quickly realized was a valuable asset in being a gigging musician. So I was able to, when in San Francisco, one night I'd play with a salsa band, the next night with a reggae band, the next night with an Afro juju band, and the next night a top 40 cover band.
It's a good quality as a musician to be able to even the various genres smoothly but efficiently, effectively. It's really cool. Now, I'm really curious, too. You had this really amazing spiritual journey along with what sounds like a very exciting career.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first become interested in traditions like Ifa? I know some of these things are very private or maybe not, you know, things you are not really supposed to share publicly or you know, they're spiritual stuff that you know what I'm saying. Tell me what you can, basically.
Yeah. Let me help you out.
In some of your training in these traditions?
Well, let me say first that part of the reason for creating this music on this album was to integrate the various parts of my life into one and break down those barriers that exist between the being a priest here and then a musician there and then a martial artist over there. You know, that's kind of what my life has been for years now, and I really wanted to break down those barriers and have it all be one thing in one place. So I don't mind speaking about my spiritual journey at all. That's kind of what I would like to do, is speak about it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and the reason that I've spoken about it on my record is specifically for this, so that people would ask me. So let's get to it. I guess it really started with my mother, who is of Cuban descent. And in our home, we had images of saints, but she called them by African names.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here we would have a Virgin of La Caridad, and she would not call it that. It wasn't a Virgin Mary, it was Oshun. And we'd have a statue of St. Barbara, and it wasn't St. Barbara, it was Chango, et cetera, et cetera. So she had been brought up with this tradition, but not to any great extent, not being a priestess, just a believer. And it was kind of just part of my upbringing that I took for granted. Around 14, 15, I started getting interested in yoga and meditation again, because my mother had taken an interest in these things. And I said, that is fascinating. And she was studying the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's transcendental meditation. And I said, that's fascinating. And I followed. And she was more of a housewife and didn't really get out much. But I decided to really study quite a bit. From there, I went out to explore the Satchidananda Center in New York and study yoga, and essentially got into Eastern religion and philosophy at a very early age, 14, 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
This was during the time that I was playing with devotion, and you can probably see how that one affected the other, just in the name of the band. The actual name of the band came from Carlos Santana's Love, Devotion, and Surrender album with John McLaughlin. He had made an album during that time that was very unpopular, but I thought was great, and it's still a classic of guitarists for the amazing guitar playing on it. This had, you know, a tremendous impact. I was following Carlos Santana's spiritual journey and say, oh, look, he's doing all this stuff with Eastern religions. Let's see what it is. And I got into it as well. Eventually, this led to studies in theosophy, just through books and studying many of the publications of the Theosophical Society. I found that through the teachings of the Theosophical Society, they believe in the essential unity of all world religions, that, of course, you can find differences, but you can also find similarities between all religions. And they choose to focus on the similarities to try to bring unity and harmony to the world, and I thought that was a great thing. I took these concepts with me to California when I moved out to California and studied with a bishop of the liberal Catholic Church, because I found him by chance. He had been a part of the Theosophical Society, and liberal Catholic Church was founded by members of the Theosophical Society. There, I tried to become a priest. I was about 18, 19. They asked me to give up percussion and play church organ.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Carlos. I'm a little curious about how you ran into this bishop. Was it just you just sort of met coincidentally through the Theosophical Society, or did you...
Completely by chance. Just Yeah, it was completely by chance. I knew of the Liberal Catholic Church before I had gone to California because of the writings of C.W. Ledbetter, who was the founder of the Liberal Catholic Church, and one of the main he's one of the main authors of the Theosophical Society books. Annie Besant, Madame Blavatsky, and C.W. Ledbetter were the ones who wrote a lot of the books. So I was familiar with him and his history, and I kind of read somewhere that he was the archbishop and founder of the Liberal Catholic Church, and kind of put it away in the back of my mind. And then I find myself in Northern California, and somebody tells me, oh, you know, there's a Liberal Catholic Church here. And I go, really? And I go, well, let me see what it is. And I went to a service, and here I found an 80-something-year-old man in a tiny, probably like a 20-by-20 room, giving sermons in a liberal Catholic church speaking about Buddha and Lao Tzu. And I go, wow, this is fascinating. This is really fascinating. You know, his sermon is not based on just the teachings of Christ, but also the Buddha and Lao Tzu. So I was drawn to it immediately. I said, wow, this is really fascinating stuff. And I stayed there for months, and probably close to a year. But eventually this idea of you have to stop playing the congas and play the church organ in order to be a priest here, we really need an organist. And I just said, it's just not who I am. It's not me. It's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. I can't give up playing the drums. Let me go back. While in New York, I had a health challenge. I had been playing so much in college that I actually started urinating blood.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And this was due to hitting my hands on a very hard surface repeatedly and causing muscle tissue breakdown of the hands.
Wow.
Long story short, doctors couldn't do anything for me, told me I would probably die of renal shutdown because it was going to clog my kidneys and kill me. Someone suggested that I see a high priest of the Akan people. The Akan people are from Ghana, and there was an Akan temple in Queens. I visited him. His name was Nana Dinizulu. He has passed. May he rest in peace.
There's an Akan temple in Queens. What isn't there in New York? I guess that's a better question. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. In Queens, New York, and it's still there. And I'm talking, you know, 30, almost 40 years ago. This is a long time ago. And he passed, and his son is now in charge of the temple. And they're still there. And the Akan temple, through Nana Dinizulu's divination, he concocted an herbal formula for me that was the only thing that actually helped. And also because of the African experience with drums and drumming being so much more profound than here in the West, he told me what I needed to hear. He said, well, you need to breathe better. You need to, this is a little personal, wear jock support.
Yeah,
yeah, it was really important. He said, you really need to wear jock support and you need to breathe and utilize your hands in a different way along with this medicine, and you'll be fine. And simply put, he was the only man that actually found a cure for this urinating blood. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had this experience with these Africans that I thought was really amazing. And, of course, it was kind of like going back to my own roots. This is what Afro-Cubans have done for centuries. But it wasn't exactly what they do. It was, you know, through a different group. So I got initiated into the Akan tribe, and they wanted me to be a priest. You know, he is the first one. Nana Dinizulu was the first man who told me that through his divination that my path was to become a priest. And I looked at him like he was insane. I said, you want me to do what? You want me to be a priest here with you? And he looked at me, he said, no, that's up to you. Yeah, exactly. That's what he was telling me. He was like, you don't necessarily have to do it here now with me. It's just, this is in your destiny. This is your fate. You will be a priest someday. I'm just telling you, and you can, you know.
Take it or leave it.
Yeah, take it or leave it. Yeah, this is what I get for you in your divination. You can take it or leave it. So I just kind of, you know, I was looking for a health solution. I found it. That was enough for me. I was more interested in Eastern things. Okay, then I go to California and I do all this training with the bishop and all that. I kind of put the African things away, you know, but I was always connected to it because of my drumming. So my drumming was always leading me back to, through my own heritage of being Cuban, into the Afro-Cuban, and from the Afro-Cuban back to the specific parts of West Africa like Nigeria and Ghana, where all of this had originated. So as I get deeper into the music, I'm also learning more about African spirituality. Mm-hmm. So it kind of was all the same thing. My musical journey was really turning into a spiritual journey without me even realizing it. I was learning more about the religious music of Cuba and its origins in Nigeria from the Yoruba people, and absolutely loved the music and was not willing to give it up. You know, obviously, you know, here I have an opportunity to be a priest at the Liberal Catholic Church, and I go, no, I can't do this, not if I have to stop playing drums. Can't do it, sorry.
Yeah, so how did Ifa find Ifa, or how did Ifa find you?
Well, through a series of explorations, musical explorations mostly, just getting deeper and deeper into the Afro-Cuban musical tradition, I found myself drawn more and more into the Afro-Cuban religious tradition. So I eventually made an about face and came right back because of the teachings of Theosophy and because of the teachings of the Liberal Catholic Church. One of the priests, not the bishop, but a different one, told me one day that he had been to India and that he was greatly disappointed in what he found in India because he thought he was going to go to one of the most spiritual places in the world where people were, you know, at a different level, and it was completely the opposite. And essentially what he was trying to tell me is it's not really a question of what religion as much as how deep one delves into it that makes all the difference. Because he found plenty of people in India that were Hindu, but, you know, not really practicing, ate meat, you know, did terrible things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it wasn't really a question of the religion. It was a question of how deep, and it was a very powerful lesson for me. And what that turned into eventually as well, what is the deeper side of my own heritage? What is the deeper mystical aspect of this Santeria, of this Yoruba tradition? And when asking, it came out that this was Ifa. And Ifa is essentially the part of the Yoruba religious tradition that is the deeper, more mystical, more occult version than the day-to-day religious associations that people have. Does that make any sense?
So, yeah, so this is almost like the, I think I understand completely that instead of the everyday practices that people, just these little rituals and things, this was something deeper that had, you know, almost a more, can I even say more theological, you know? So
yes.
With a more rigorous practice, or?
Yes. When someone becomes initiated into Ifa, they are called bishop, not priest. In other words, you're a high priest, not the average clergy. The average clergy is kind of the overseers of the believers. But the Babalao is the overseer of the believers and the priesthood. The average clergy come to the Babalaos for guidance and help and particularly divination.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the most important functions that we provide for the community as well as the priesthood, is the divination. Essentially what it is that we believe that there is a spirit known as Orumila who incarnated as a man at one time, living, breathing human being, but his life has many mysteries, like he lived supposedly over the course of 700 years in 7 different places, which is kind of impossible, yet there are places where they say that there are relics of when he was alive in these places and then just mysteriously walked away after 100 years and then popped up somewhere else, you know. So there's a great mystery whether he's an immortal or whether this is a spirit incarnating. We don't know. But the important thing is that he is the embodiment of wisdom. And as such, as being the embodiment of wisdom, we as Babalaos contact this spirit in order for this spirit to guide our divination tools to be able to make divination for ourselves as well as other people. That's the most important function. Of course, there are many other functions that a Babalao serves, but that in essence is... That's what I've been doing for the past 18, 19 years.
And how does it affect, I know you do a lot of different projects with a whole variety of different kinds of collaborators, but it seems like this is a really powerful calling. It's not the kind of thing that necessarily you can just, you know, hang by the door when you come into a session. How do you navigate that difference between, say, the secular, commercialized music world and the sacred music world?
Well, for... Let me start back in Los Angeles. I was in 1986. My wife and I moved to Los Angeles. We were there from 86 to 94. In 1992 is when I finally decided that I was going to fulfill this destiny of becoming a priest, and I traveled to Nigeria and became initiated into Ifa in Nigeria. Unfortunately, 2 years later was the Northridge quake in Los Angeles. We lost our home, and I was injured, and we survived and decided to move back to New York. For me, it was moving back. For my wife and child, it was their first time here on the East Coast. During the time that I was in California, I had already traveled with Confunction, with Laura Branigan internationally, with Arturo Sandoval, with Jose Feliciano, with Strunz and Farah, with a lot of people. I had a good career traveling around the world as a touring musician. And when I decided to come to New York, that kind of changed, because I really wanted to stay home more for my son. I didn't want to be a constantly on the road and not being available for my son and for my family. So I found that it was a lot easier in New York than in California to make a living from playing weddings and bar mitzvahs and the kind of work let me say this. I could have worked on Broadway, but I simply do not like the music on Broadway.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, I just, it was just...
Maybe Fellow, you know, there's an occasional thing that...
Yeah, exactly. Cape Man was, you know, that was Latin music and Celia Cruz. Yeah, but still, you know, the idea of playing the same music over and over and over again in the same place would just drive me crazy. Because I was used to being a traveling musician, you know, and it was much easier for me to just settle into making a whole lot of money playing local gigs, because the nightclubs never really pay terrible, you know. Nightclubs pay miserably. But these corporate parties and weddings and bar mitzvahs paid great, because nobody wanted it. I was willing to do it, so I settled into a groove here, into just playing all these jobs and working, you know, and coming home and being with my family every day.
It became almost like you were an artisan, like a craftsman, like, you know, you were building a good barrel, and then you go, you know, as a barrel maker, you don't. You know what I'm saying? You could have pleasure in a craft.
That's right. That's
it. You go home and edit a job, and come and take that.
My philosophy has always been, as long as I'm not doing something else, as long as I'm playing my drums, I'll hire myself to anyone. I don't care. Anyone that'll pay. That's the bottom line. If you pay me, I'll be there. That's it. That was the bottom line for me. So I by doing all of this, what I've been doing for the past 17 years that I've been back is constantly playing top 40, more than anything else, more than Latin music, more than any other style of music. What I've done is play everything that's popular now, all of the latest from you name it, I play it. And
consciousness, not in a bad way, but I'm saying maybe suddenly you realize that there's something really good in that Black Eyed Peas song that you never really would have heard if you hadn't played it 200 times.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly right. First, it happened on a religious level. Because I was trying to be a priest, you know, actively seeking to live out my initiation that I had gotten 2 years prior in and I had training while living in Los Angeles, and then here I am now in New York, and people are actually seeking me out for divination and actively becoming a part of my life, and I have many, many godchildren. Because I was staying home, that's what was making that possible. So the music of playing these weddings and bar mitzvahs, then in my mind, it turned into, well, you know, they are clean, healthy, religious ceremonies. I see no conflict here. I'm a priest, and I'm playing at weddings and bar mitzvahs. These are religious festivals that people are celebrating. And besides, I didn't have to put up with cigarette smoke. You know. Yeah, exactly. I was taken out of the unhealthy environment of the sex, drugs, you know, that came along with the rock and roll, and put into this much cleaner environment where there was, you know, no sex, no drugs, no smoking, and it was all about, you know, just this beautiful ceremony. People, so I was getting into it. It was like, okay, yeah, I'm here to make people happy on the happiest day of their lives. I can get into that. That's nice. You know, I had no problem with it. But after all these years, you know, I now feel like, well, you know, I've done that. And I really need to express myself. Mm-hmm. Because I've been just the hands that others use for so many years. You know, what was the last thing I did? I was playing for Martha Washington of the... Do you know who Martha Washington is?
Not the musician.
Yeah, the Two Tons of Fun, the Weather Girls.
Yeah.
I played with her a few months ago, and Gloria Gaynor, and before that, I was playing with Eartha Kitt for a few years, and while here in New York, I did records for Mariah Carey, for Sade, for the Pet Shop Boys, for Maxwell. I've done well. I can't complain.
Exactly. You've had some really exciting. Opportunities.
Yeah, but it's always being the hands of someone else's music. Mm. And finally, something happened that it was really through my spiritual journey that something happened within me that then caused me to want to express myself as an artist for the first time. I became aware of something called Merkaba meditation techniques. Now I'm skipping way ahead. I've done a million different things, and, you know, from the Afro-Cuban babalao to experimenting with many different things. And eventually I come upon this, you know, Merkaba meditation. I go, okay, I want to see what this is about. What is sacred geometry and what is Merkaba meditation? And I come across a publication that says this guy's going to be here. And, oh, yeah, let me go see. Jim Self is going to be here in Connecticut. And then I look at the date. Oh, I just missed it by a day. That's terrible. But let me find out when he's going to be here again. So I call, and it's going to be a year before he's back. I wait, and I go. I took a seminar. A weekend seminar, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Now, what he calls inner alchemy meditation techniques is what we were taught during this weekend seminar. What I can say is that I've never meditated for more than 20 minutes at any one sit-down session, and for the first time, we were meditating for hours and hours and hours at a time, and I had I guess, what one would call an epiphany or a revelation, a out-of-body experience. Whatever you want to call it is fine with me. It was a unique experience in my life. Mm-hmm. Something happened during meditation where I was transported to a different place and felt very present in a different place, knowing full well that my body was somewhere else. It really, for me, was what I had been seeking for all of my life, is some personal experience, something that happens that is not read in a book, that is not taught to you by someone, that is a deeply personal experience. That's what I was seeking. And that's what happened that weekend. Something, a very deeply personal, transforming experience. When I came out of that place, I had a revelation that I really needed to change my life. That I was going in a direction that was not good for me. That the years and years of martial arts training had taken me down a path of violence that I really did not want. It wasn't violence that I was seeking. I was merely seeking physical self-cultivation. But it had turned into this violent thing, and I didn't want to do that anymore. I really wanted to explore my inner self and put it on record as sound. I really felt for the first time that I had something to say, that this is an inner journey, and what this music is for me is an expression in sound of what it is to explore within. That's how this record started.
That's really wonderful. So now, actually, I think I would love to ask you, I have a lot of other questions, but I really want to get to some of the tracks, because it sounds like the tracks themselves, as you, after this revelation, there was probably a very interesting process as you were, you know, trying to unpack all of this or unfold, you know, this or follow this journey and turn it into a, you know, a concrete piece of music. So, do you mind if I ask you about the tracks? You can tell me sort of...
Sure.
For lack of a better way of putting it, the story behind them, or how they came to you, or how you worked on them, or if there were any challenges in playing them or recording them, because I think that'd be really interesting to hear about. The first track, which is the title I love, is Water Dragon, and that has an Eastern overtone, correct? And there's
some, yeah.
Sort of idea of the spirits that inhabit water being dragons in China and Mongolia, for instance, and parts of the world. So how did that track come about?
Well, that track came about in, it wasn't the first one. I had established a theme for the entire record, and that theme was trance, hypnotism, inner exploration. Okay, generally that's what I wanted to do with all of the music, was create trance-like sounds. So one of those sounds, of course, everyone knows, is water. That's how that track started, is by first putting together layers of water. And you might not know it or realize it until you dig deep and really listen, but there are many kinds of water going. There's bubbling streams, there's waterfalls, there's rain. There are many different tracks in there. It's multi-layered. And that's what I created first, was the water. To use that as a drone. Almost every track has a drone of some sort. Something that is constant. And that was done on purpose to entrance, to hypnotize, to put people into a different state of mind other than the ordinary day-to-day state of mind, to pull you in and put you in a trance. Okay, so here you have raindrops, and you have storm sounds, and you have these babbling brooks and waterfalls, and that's constant in the background. It's just going constant in the background. So after building that, then I decided to relate to movement. Okay, what does water imply in terms of movement? And movement of water is circular. The movement of water is spiraling. The movement of water is essentially feminine. So, in that concept, I decided to start using instruments and a first tempo. It had to be something slow. Something that went along with the watery drone. But then on top of that, it had to be something that would make one move slow and consistently, not fast and vigorously. So that's how the next step after the drone was the tempo. I had to choose a tempo that made you move in such a way as to cause this cyclical movement. I wanted people to feel a spiraling, feel a circle. And that's essentially how the tune grew, because the image of the dragon in water is those snake-like movements of no straight lines, of constantly spiraling, swirling, creating circles and semicircles, but never really straight lines. And that's essentially what Water Dragon is about. Exploring cyclical movement within your body. It's kind of hard to explain on the phone.
No, you're explaining it perfectly.
Oh, okay.
Perfectly, actually. So It's always hard to know if you're explaining it well, but you actually are explaining it well. I'm getting a great feel for it. That's really cool. So what about law of attraction? What's the sort of constant behind that track?
Well, first, let me say that voice that's not my voice. That is Jim Self. That's the man that I went to study with. In Massachusetts, I spent a weekend at his class studying with him and going through meditations, and eventually led to this really unbelievable transformational experience for me. So I really wanted to include him in some way. And he has a website, inneralchemy.com. On that website, he has tons and tons of speeches. And I wanted to get something that was very basic in terms of metaphysical concepts to put, if I was to put words, because basically, as you can tell, most of it is just instrumental. If I'm going to put words, and they have to be words that relate to the essential message of the entire record, that there is a certain spirituality of music. This is not just, you know, party music. You know, it's really for going within. Listen to the record. I always recommend that people just relax and don't have any other distractions. And mm-hmm. And that's the best way to listen to this. It's not while you're working, doing something else. Really, just listen. And really put on some headphones and just listen. And then see if you can move with the music as well. And try to internalize. So anyway, in this track, I again tried to use as many different hypnotic kinds of sounds. Like the Chinese bell tree. Is a nice, I always find it very mystical sounding. You know, the dring and triangles always create a nice effect for just putting people in a real pleasant state of mind. These are sounds that are generally considered by almost anyone to be pleasant, beautiful, ringing. So there's lots of bells that are creating the drones here. The Chinese bell tree, the triangles, there's other kartals and things like this that are being used to create long, ringing, sustained notes to be able to create that drone that I looked for in every track. And then, of course, the message of Law of Attraction is really an important part of my life, and I think could be helpful to others as well, and that's why I put it out. That is a 1.5 hour speech cut down to just a few minutes. I actually edited all of the speech down to the essentials of what he was trying to say.
Cool. I'll have to listen more closely to that. I listen to it the less correct way. With I'll try to do 10 other things, which is unfortunately not the best way to do this album, and I'll have to remedy that before I write this. So I was also curious about, I'm skipping around a little bit in terms of the track order. What is Arebu Adudua about? Does that reference any of your Ifa background? Or?
Yep, absolutely.
So tell me more about that. That's very intriguing.
Arebu Adudua is the name of a traditional piece of music in the Afro-Cuban Santeria tradition. It is something that I play ceremonially all the time. It's a very beautiful and mysterious melody. And I had been saying that I wanted to do something with that when I had a friend, Matt Baranello, who's a fellow Babalawo. He said, "Hey, you know, let me make something of this tune." I said, "Go ahead, you know, I'm working on some other stuff and you work on that." And he presented something to me and I said, "Well, it doesn't have the hypnotic qualities that I'm really looking for in all of my material for this record. So let me remix it." And we together worked on this piece to bring a traditional piece of music and turn it into kind of a more pop-ish piece. So the melody is really a very ancient, very beautiful, mysterious melody. And we actually used a clip in there of Lázaro Ross, who was one of my teachers many years ago, of Afro-Cuban singing. He has passed away, and may he rest in peace as well. He was considered the greatest singer of this genre of Afro-Cuban music. So in order to honor him, because he passed away just a few years ago, and in order to make this beautiful, mysterious melody into something more accessible, we decided to use this melody and turn it into a more danceable, pop-ish kind of thing. Because from the beginning of the record to the end, it's really kind of worked out as I saw it as a workout. You start out slow and warming up, and at the very end, it's when it gets to its fastest. And then the very last tune is Sit Down and Meditate. It really, the entire record is really a workout. That's the way you start with Water Dragon moving in very slow spirals. And as the music progresses to get slowly faster and faster and faster, then you move more intensely. So Aremu Odudua is one of the faster tunes. It's not the fastest, but it's the part where you really are starting to move and connect with your body. The connection between Odudua, the deity, and your body is that the symbol of Odudua is a skeleton. And the reason that the symbol for Odudua is a skeleton is that Oduduwa is the progenitor of the Yoruba people. He's a Moses, an Abraham-like figure in Yoruba tradition. He's the founder of all the Yoruba people. So all of the kings of the Yoruba people are descendants of this one king named Oduduwa. So that idea that his symbol is the skeleton, because his DNA is what is kept alive today, consciously, by keeping the kingship and all of this. It's kind of a symbol for all of us being connected to our own DNA. So my idea in terms of movement for, because it was continuously throughout everything that I did, it was always music, spirituality, and movement. Music, spirituality, and movement. How do you relate to movement in a spiritual way in this music? Well, this was more about the bones and connecting to your skeleton, visualizing your in your internal process, connecting to your bones. This is a part of Qigong. This is which is a part of my martial arts practice. There are certain Qigong practices where you connect internally through meditation to your bones. You are visualizing going through your bones, adding qi, giving yourself a cleansing as well as an empowerment to improve health literally from your bones all the way out. As a matter of fact, the bone marrow qigong is one of the tools that has been used for curing leukemia. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what I'm trying to bring out in this song. Yes, it has something to do with Oduduwa. Yes, this is a traditional melody. But beyond that, if you can, and that's why I wrote the liner notes, if you can dance and think of your own skeleton dancing, not just your flesh and bones, but literally connect to the bone part of your being, what you're doing, according to Qigong principles, is connecting to your DNA. And in so connecting to your DNA structure, you're connecting to your ancestry and the deepest parts of who and what you are, and that which you are built upon, your ancestry. You are literally, your body is a composite of all of your ancestors. And that's where, in your bone marrow, by going internally into your bones, this is where you connect to your ancestry. So, I mean, it's something that I practice.
No, I love the way you're weaving together all these things that have had such an important impact on your life. It's really great. It's beautiful. And I want to make sure we could talk about a couple more tracks here, just so I have enough. I don't want to, you know.
Okay.
I don't want to hit any themes too hard so that you feel like something's been neglected. So, just so you know, if you know, when you get the draft back, we do see this process as a dialogue. So mm-hmm. It's not like the draft is kind of like a, I don't know, it's not like a take it or leave it type thing. It's a, you know, you can look at it and say, oh, wow, I really wish I'd mentioned more about this story. Or, you know, if you want to look back at this part of the liner notes, maybe we should emphasize this a bit more. You know, it can be a back and forth about about the kind of images we want to put forward. So, anyway, just to keep that in mind.
Okay.
So what is that? And I was also really intrigued by
Metuneter.
What's the origin of that piece?
Well, I guess I kind of skipped over that, so I'll go back there. When I was in New York playing with Seguida, I was also studying at the Rosicrucian Anthroposophical Society in Harlem. There, I met a man named Rogelio Strong, who goes, his pen name is Ra Un Nefer Amen. He's written many, many books, especially now. Even then, he had a few books under his belt, but now he's got tons and tons of books. I studied astrology, herbalism, vegetarianism, I Ching, Taoism, meditation techniques of Taoists, Vedantins, and Kabbalists, amongst many other things. One of his books is entitled Metuneter.
Ah.
And that book is what I feel can serve as a very important tool to many people. Many people are confused where to go, what to do, should I do this, should I do that, who do I turn to, what do I do? This is what divination was created for, to give people a means of guiding their lives through connection with spirit. I do this as a babalao, but my divination tools are reserved only for us. Metuneter is a divination tool accessible to anyone and everyone. It's really just using tarot cards, but not in a traditional way. What Ra tried to do with the writing of that book was use all of the aforementioned Vedantin, so from India, Taoist from China, and Kabbalist, the Jewish mysticism, put it all together and go back to the source of it all, which is Hamidic, which is the proper way of saying Egypt. Hamit was the original name of Egypt. Hamit. So what he did was try to use all of these different philosophies and make each and every one of the cards of the tarot have even more significance and symbolism, use all of this, all of this multiculturalism, let's say, put it into the symbolism. And there, and so what an average person can do, if in doubt, in question, I don't know where to go, don't know what to do, should I do it this way, should I do it that way, by using tarot cards, just simply ask spirit for help. Say, I ask the spirits of the tarot to help me. Here, I'm going to pull out one card, and only one card, and have lots of meaning. Let's see how this works. That's essentially what the Metuneter system is a tarot card system. And its origins are ancient Egypt, but it's far more than just that. It's a modern system as well. It's an oracle.
What's the musical frame for this? I mean, for the way you're presenting this incredibly deep and complicated material. So what's the drone in this track, and what was the musical inspiration? How do you channel something like that musically?
Well, it has a slightly Middle Eastern quality to it, but I know that what we today consider Middle Eastern is quite possibly has nothing to do with what was played in ancient Egypt. So I wanted to make sure that I had something that was slightly reminiscent of Middle Eastern, but not entirely. And have a droning effect to it, but also be rhythmic, because this was now one of the up-tempo songs that was going to take you to an even faster tempo. So in creating Metuneter, what I did was try to, my playing in Metuneter, my conga playing in Metuneter, is kind of the driving force there. What I was trying to do was constantly change in such an incredibly subtle way that you don't even notice the change. And that's really the metaphysical part of the song, is this subtle change that is barely noticeable. It's something that I've been working on for many, many, many years. I've played lots and lots of pop music, and pop music almost always requires absolute, precise repetition. Okay, back in the old days. Nowadays, you record, two bars and just let the computer do it. But I was around when you had to do it physically. You had to play 10 minutes straight of exactly the same thing, exactly the same way, with absolute precision. I did that for many years, and that's how I've gotten on so many records. So with this, I'm kind of breaking that mold. What I'm trying to do here instead is there's actually constant change, and you barely even notice it. That's the drone, that I'm playing something that appears to be the same thing over and over and over, and it's really not. There are constant changes. Almost every bar is different, in fact. And I'm making these subtle, constant changes. So every once in a while, that is different. And that's where the hypnotism of this track is, and the Africanism of it as well, to bring Egypt back to its being African as opposed to it being Middle Eastern. So that's kind of the intent of that song, is to get you to move, feel like there's a constant, but it really isn't a constant. It's subtle change. That's really what's going on there. You might not even notice it. At first you go, wow, it's just repeating the same thing. No, that's not right. That's not it. Because I know...
Not much like life.
Exactly. So that's
exactly... Matthew
is now available.
Very, very cool. I like that idea.
That's exactly what it is. That's what you learn from the divination. That's what you learn from using divination tools, that things may appear to be the same, but they're actually not.
Very cool. So, is there anything else that you want to make sure gets in the press release? Obviously you have a whole lifetime's worth of things, and you've sent along a lot of really interesting information I've been trying to absorb. But is there an angle or an aspect or something that we haven't had a chance to speak about that you want to make sure gets into the release? And as I said, this isn't your final say. So if nothing comes to mind at the moment, not a big deal. You can always send an email, or we can communicate as we work on the draft. But anything come to mind at the moment?
Yeah.
Great.
I'm a talker, as you can see. Yeah.
Better than the other way. Better than getting one-word answers. I've had interviews like that, too, mostly with Norwegians and people of the North.
Well, I do want to let people know that I'm coming to this project with the intention of sharing information. The titles were chosen to stimulate interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what they're there for. You know, I picked Metuneter so that someone would ask me, what is Metuneter? I picked Aremo Odudua so that people would ask me, what is that? What is these strange words that you have? What are they? That's exactly why I chose them. I wish to share information with people. That's my number one goal, is more... I want the music to be a vehicle for sharing information. This I see as my priestly role, but not just information. I want to be able to help people on an internalization process. Using secular music, which... people dance to. I've been a part of this dance music scene for many years, and I know very well how wonderful it is to just dance. I love dancing myself. I love movement. You know, that's why I've been involved in yoga and martial arts and dancing, too, for many, many, many years. But this can be, movement can be used for internalization. And I think many people are unaware of this, and I would like to be one of those people informing others that you can, in fact, utilize dance to bring yourself to a state of ecstasy and bliss. And there are people that are very aware of this, but there are still people that are not aware. And I simply want to be one of the ones helping to spread that message that dancing isn't always about finding sexual partners. You know, which seems to be what everyone thinks. That's what the great majority of people in the world today think, that dancing is for finding a sexual partner. Yes, that's true. However, there is also dancing for your spirit, dancing for your joy, for your own personal joy. And beyond just enjoyment, it can turn into a trance that can turn into an ecstatic state. That's my message.
That's great. And very well put. Excellent. I love it. And so what I'm going to do, Carlos, is I'm going to work on a draft over the next couple days and work with Garrett and Dimitri on that. And then we will send you something. And as I said, it's just the beginning. It's not a final, you know, this is what we think the draft should look like. It's sort of, you know, this is the first draft, and if you have reactions and ideas and things that you want to add, that's fine. So we'll kind of go back and forth. I'm thinking that we'll get you the first round on Tuesday.
Okay.
And just so you know, I like to focus on stories. Like, I like to put people's, there's so much music out there, and journalists are so overwhelmed with the amount of things being tossed their way. So what we found has been really effective, especially for artists who are coming from perspectives that are kind of outside of the narrow band of rock and pop,
mm-hmm.
is to really get into to really describe in sort of colorful, vibrant stories their process, their lives, their process, where the art comes from, and why they make it. And that's actually a lot of people find it really, really persuasive, and it'll catch a lot of eyes that, you know, just when... You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of press releases tend to be basically either laundry lists of names or kind of like classified ads writ large. And so we like to try to do something a little bit more, I don't know, poetic. I can't think of a better way to put it. But
beautiful. Beautiful.
So if someone's been in the industry for a while, you're probably going to be used to something a little bit shorter, a little bit drier, and maybe slightly hypier. But we like to keep things a little bit more... focused on the narrative. So we're willing to work with you to get something that we want you to love it. So that's the bottom line. Anyway, just wanted to throw that out there so that when you get the draft, you're not like, this is really weird. That happens sometimes. People just don't quite know where we're coming from. But it's an approach that's worked really well for us over the years. So, and I think it's going to work well with your amazing material and thoughts and music. So I hope you agree. Anyway, thanks so much for your time. It's been really interesting talking to you, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, I'm getting over it now. Still not completely well, but definitely, I was in bed a couple of days ago, just really feeling miserable, yeah. And on your end, I hope everyone is feeling better now, too. What was it, your mother-in-law that was not feeling well?
Yeah, my mother-in-law was just, she never gets sick and gets, you know, flu shots and all that kind of stuff, but she...